Galatea 3, and Pygmalion too. The Isle of Cyprus, being the landing ground of spume-born Aphrodite, had long worshipped the goddess of love and beauty with a special fervour, earning Cypriots a reputation for libertine licentiousness and libidinous loose living. Cyprus was thought of by the mainland as a degenerate place, an island of free love. One group of women, the daughters of Propetus from the southern port town of Amathus, indignant at the amount of sexual license that pervaded there, went so far as to suggest that Aphrodite should no longer stand as the island's patroness. To punish such blasphemous impertinence, the wrathful Aphrodite visited upon these sanctimonious sisters feelings of insatiable carnal lust, at the same time ridding them of any sense of modesty or shame. So cursed, the women lost the ability to blush and began eagerly and indiscriminately to prostitute their bodies about the island. A sensitive and wildly attractive young sculptor called Pygmalion saw the flagrant and shameless behaviour of the Propetides and grew so disgusted that he decided to forswear all love and sex in perpetuity. "Women," he muttered to himself as he set to work one morning on a commission to render in marble the face and figure of a general from Limassol. "You won't find me wasting my time on women. Oh, no, art is enough. Art is all. Love is nothing. Art is everything. Art is..." Well, now, that's strange. Pygmalion stepped back to look at his work and wrinkled his brow in surprise. His general was taking shape in the oddest way. He could have sworn the man had a beard. Furthermore, the old warrior may have been a little on the tubby side, but Pygmalion was sure he didn't sport a pair of swelling breasts. Nor were his neck and throat so slender, smooth, and irresistibly. Pygmalion went out into the yard and dipped his head in the fountain of cold water that played there. Returning refreshed to the studio, he looked again at his work in progress and could only shake his head in bewilderment. The general, when Pygmalion had been permitted to go round to his villa to study the great man's features, had struck him as being constructed more on the lines of a warthog than anything human, and yet here he was, emerging from the marble as nothing short of a refined and miraculous beauty, a distinctly feminine beauty at that. Picking up a chisel, Pygmalion ran his artist's eye over the work and knew that with some merciless and well-aimed blows he could easily enough get back on course and not waste the valuable block of marble for which he had paid a month's income. Crack, crack, crack. That was more like it. Tap, tap, tap. Must have been some weird subconscious urge. Chip, chip, chip. Or indigestion, perhaps. Now, let's step back again and see. No! Far from rescuing the work and bringing the general's masculine and martial glare back to the face of his sculpture, he had somehow managed only to amplify its soft femininity, grace, sensuality, and, God damn it, sexiness. He was in a fever now. Deep inside, he knew he was no longer rescuing the general. He was on a mission to see through to the end the madness that had seized him. The madness was, of course, the work of Aphrodite. She had not been pleased when one of the handsomest and most eligible young men of her island had chosen to turn his back on love. A young man, moreover, whose seaside dwelling happened to be exactly where Aphrodite had made landfall after her birth in the waves, and ought therefore, she reasoned, to vibrate with a special intensity of amorousness. Love and beauty, as most of us find out in the course of our lives, are remorseless, relentless, and ruthless. For days and nights, Pygmalion laboured on in a frenzy of creativity, of literal enthusiasm. Generations of artists in all media since might have recognized the agonized, breathless ecstasy of inspiration that had seized him. No thought of food or drink, no conscious thought at all, came into his mind as he tapped, hammered, and hummed. At last, as the pink flush of Eos and a nacreous flash of light from the east betokened the beginning of his fifth continuous day of work, he stepped back with the miraculous knowledge that only true artists understand, that somehow, yes, certainly, at last, it was finished. He hardly dared raise his eyes. All his work thus far had been up close, detailed. The lineaments of the complete figure existed only in some inaccessible dark corner of his mind. For the first time, he could take it all in. He took a deep breath and looked. He cried out in shock and dropped his chisel. From its exquisitely rendered toes to the perfectly worked flowers that wreathed the hair on its head, the sculpture was far and away the best thing he had ever done. More than that, it was surely the most absolutely beautiful work of art that had ever been seen in the world. To a true artist like Pygmalion, this meant it was more beautiful than any person that had ever been seen on Earth, for he knew that art always exceeds the best that nature can manage. Yet he saw that the figure he had rendered in marble from his enraptured imagination was more than the most absolutely beautiful thing now in the world. She was real. To Pygmalion, she was more real than the ceiling above his head and the floor beneath his feet. His heart was beating fast. His pupils had dilated, his breath was short, and the very core of his being stirred in the most powerful and disturbing manner. It was joy and pain all at once. It was love. The expression and posture of the girl, whose name he knew should be Galatea, for her marble loveliness was white as milk, was caught in a moment of sublime hesitation between awakening and wonder. She seemed a little surprised, as if on the verge of gasping. At what? At the beauty of the world? At the handsomeness of the young artist who was feasting his eyes so hungrily upon her? Her features were regular and perfect, but so were the features of many girls. There was more to her than conventional appeal. An inner loveliness of soul sang from her very core. Her lines were sweepingly, swoopingly, swooningly smooth, supple, and sensuous. Her breasts seemed softly to be pushing out. Her nakedness made so much more alluring by the way her hand touched her throat in a gesture of sweetly modest alarm. Pygmalion walked around her to take in the thrilling generosity of the curve of her buttocks and the glorious fullness of her thighs. Dared he put a hand to that flesh? He reached out gently so as not to bruise her. But his fingers met cold marble. Hard, unyielding marble. To the eye, and through to the depths of her, Galatea seemed quick, warm, and alive. But to Pygmalion's stroking hands, and to the loving cheek he rested on her side, she was as cold as death. He felt both sick and supercharged with life at one and the same time. He jumped up and down, he shouted out loud, he groaned, he laughed, he sang, he swore. He exhibited all the wild, deranged, furious, euphoric, and despairing behaviours of a young man tempestuously and frighteningly in love. At last he threw himself at his Galatea, encircled her with his arms and with his legs, nuzzled himself against her, kissing and pawing and rubbing until everything inside him exploded. The madness that consumed his soul did not abate after that first frenzy. He now devoted himself to Galatea with all the ardour and attentive tenderness of a true lover. He called her affectionate names. He went out to the market and bought her gowns, garlands, and trinkets. He adorned her wrists with bangles and bracelets, and her throat with necklaces and pendants of jasper and pearl. He bought a couch that he adorned with silks of Tyrian purple. He lay her upon it and sang ballads to her. Like most great visual artists, he was an incompetent musician and a deplorable poet. His love was passionate and generous, but, except to his fevered imagination in its most optimistic moods, wholly unreciprocated. This was a one-way wooing, and in the depths of his bursting heart he knew it. The day came for the festival of Aphrodite. Pygmalion kissed the cold but lovely Galatea goodbye and left the house. All of Cyprus and thousands of visitors from the mainland had gathered for this annual holiday. The great square in front of the temple was crowded with pilgrims who came to pray to the goddess of love and beauty for success in matters of the heart. Garlanded heifers were sacrificed, the air was thick with frankincense, and every column of the temple had been entwined with flowers. The prayers came thick, fast, and loud. Send me a wife, send me a husband, improve my performance, slow me down, take these feelings away from me, make Menander fall for me, stop Xanthippe from cheating on me. Beseeching cries and wails filled the air. Pygmalion shouldered blindly through the press of peddlers and petitioners. He reached the temple steps, bribed the guards, coaxed the priestesses, and at last was led into the inner sanctum, where only the richest and most influential citizens were allowed to pray directly in front of a great statue of Aphrodite. He fell to his knees before it. Great goddess of love, he whispered, it is said that you grant wishes to ardent lovers on this your festal day. Grant the wish of a poor artist who begs that you might... At the altar rail, important men and women were babbling their imprecations to Aphrodite, and although the chances of Pygmalion being overheard were slim, some kind of modesty or shame stopped him from uttering his real desire. A poor artist who begs that you might provide him with a real, living girl, just like the one he fashioned from marble. Grant this, dread goddess, and you will have won a devoted slave whose life and art will be devoted always to the service and praise of love. An amused Aphrodite saw through the prayer. She knew perfectly well what Pygmalion really wanted. The candles on the altar in front of him flared up and leapt into the air 9 times. Pygmalion flew home. To his dying day, he could not tell you the way he went or how long he took. He may have knocked over 1 person or 40 as he charged through the crowds. The lifeless statue is lying on its gorgeous couch just as he left it. Never has the carved figure seemed less accessible or more icily remote. Yet, with the faith and demented fury of the love-struck, Pygmalion kneels down and kisses the cold brow. He kisses it once, twice, 20 times. Then he kisses its neck, its cheeks, and wait, is it just the fire of his kisses that has warmed the marble? Or can he feel a growing heat beneath his hungry lips? He can. Beneath the touch of his mouth, the unyielding stone is easing into flesh, into quick, warm, delicious flesh. Again and again he kisses, and as the wax from the honeycomb softens and melts in the sun, so the cold ivory of his beloved softens from each gentle caress of mouth and hand. He is amazed. He cannot believe. He puts a finger to the veins of her arm and feels the surge and pulse of hot human blood. He stands. Can it be true? Can it be true? He cradles Galatea in his arms and feels her frame expanding as she takes in her first breaths of air. It is true. She lives. Aphrodite, I bless you. Aphrodite, greatest of all the gods, I thank you and pledge myself to serve you always. He bends down to meet warm lips that eagerly return his kisses. Soon the pair are in each other's arms, laughing, weeping, sighing, and loving. 9 times the moon changes before the union of this happy pair is blessed with the birth of a child, Paphos, whose name is given to the town in which Pygmalion and Galatea live out the remainder of their loving and contented lives. Just once or twice in Greek myth, mortal lovers are granted a felicitous ending. It is that hope, perhaps, that spurs us on to believe that our quest for happiness is not futile. Paphian becomes a word to describe Aphrodite and the arts of love. George Bernard Shaw chose Pygmalion as the title for his play about a man who tries to turn a Cockney girl into a Mayfair lady.